Hellman on CliffCentral.com.
All right, JD Durkin joins us now live on the line from New York. JD, how's it going?
I'm good, man. How have you been? Thanks for having me back on the show.
Yeah, great to have you. I feel so dumb, though, because I always forget how to pronounce Mediaite. I always get this wrong.
You nailed it. That's it, my man. Mediaite.
Oh, there we go. Fantastic. All right. JD, of course, that is the publication that you're an editorial producer and columnist for. Okay, so there's a hell of a lot going on the political spectrum. Before we take a look at who the next leaders might be, let's take a look at the current leader of the United States of America, Obama, on this historic trip to Cuba. Just for someone that doesn't understand quite fully why this was such big news, fill us in real quick.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, Kelman, the history between Cuba and the United States, it stretches back several generations. It's a very, very contentious past. You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, many U.S. presidents have not had very good relationships with the country, but it is very powerful geographically where Cuba is located. It's located very close off the coast of Florida. We have a huge, very proud Cuban population that has moved here. And so President Obama is the first sitting U.S. president in nearly a century, if you can imagine. I think it's about 88 years, 90 years or so to actually visit Cuba while he's still in office. And this whole thing is really part of what people look at and say, all right, this is Barack Obama's legacy. This is one of the things he wants to effectively leave behind, to say he was the president that made significant strides towards healing the longtime fractured dynamic between Cuba and the United States. So it was very historic for a lot of reasons. It's something that, of course, prior to the Belgium attacks that everyone's been following closely this week. Before that, all of the American media was following it very closely, because there is a lot of history being made with the president's trip to Cuba.
At this point, I mean, is it just about legacy for Obama? He's come in, he did what he feels like he could do, and now it's just really about, you know, his personal brand. I mean, do you think he's still got a lot of stuff that he wants to achieve and what's left of his term of office? Or do you think now it's just about him very consciously, you know, thinking about how he's going to be remembered?
Well, I actually think the answer, I think it's a yes to both of those questions. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. What I mean is, I think he's going to work very hard. I think he's a president, and everything indicates he's going to work up until his last minutes as president before next January's inauguration of whoever wins the election, to ensure that the legacy and things that are left behind are effective. But, you know, what's pretty interesting to us is, you know, we look at, and obviously, so he was elected to two terms. Each term is 4 years, of course, here in the United States, so it'll be 8 years together. And in his first term, the president was a little more hands-off. He had to really develop the trust of the American people, relationships with people he had to work alongside with. And I think he knew he really couldn't do too much in his first term to jeopardize a potential second term. But as soon as he won his reelection nomination, the second term completely changed. He knew he had done it, and this whole second term has just been about a lot of these legacy pieces. Now, Kelman, there are still things that he wants to do. He wants to close Guantanamo Bay. He wants to make establish relationships with some immigrant communities a little stronger. So it's definitely going to be, election aside, it's going to be a very, very busy remaining 10 months or so to Obama's presidency, I think.
Let's talk about the recent Belgium attacks. Obviously, once again, just terrorism rearing its ugly head. But what's interesting in this context is that the Belgium attacks will then be used by different, you know, players on the American political scene to sort of tell different narratives and to showcase in different ways, you know, what they are and what they're about. In an Obama context, I mean, his take on the Belgium attacks, I know that there was some talk around the fact that he stayed at the baseball game during his Cuba trip after hours, after the Belgium attacks. So what, in his context, what does the Belgium attacks mean?
Well, I think this is a very cool, calm, and collected sort of guy, right? Like, Barack Obama has always given off the optics of the type of president he is, right? Like, you always see him in sunglasses. He's always the coolest one in the room. He's always the funniest one in the room. So part of that, which is a style of leadership, not everyone may agree with it, but it's the sort of president that he has been, and in a lot of ways has been very successful. So in keeping with that, when we see these horrible attacks, these horrible things go around the world, part of his leadership choice of what he chooses to do is to say, hey, listen, life needs to go on. And if we completely drop everything that we do and we start panicking and we, right, that's when they win, right? That's a conversation we've had in this country really since 9/11. We say if we allow our day-to-day lives, the things that we care about, spending time with our loved ones, if those things start getting jeopardized, then they win. And so I think the move for the president, for President Obama, was, look, he was in Cuba. There was a baseball game. There were a lot of big U.S. athletes who were there. People like Derek Jeter, who was a longtime New York Yankee player, was there at the game. And for the president, I think he felt like it's more important for him to still be seen out at that public venue. He could still shake hands. He could still show that kind of life goes on. Another thing is that the presidency is really built up, at least today, where no matter where in the world the president is, he can still do his job just as effectively as if he were in Washington, pretty much. So when something like this happens, although he's in Havana, although he's in Cuba, he can certainly engage with the American people. He could certainly speak to his closest advisors about the Belgium attacks. And ultimately, he didn't feel like it was necessary to leave Cuba, although Belgium had just fallen under attacks.
All right, JD, we've covered everything to do with Obama. We now have to speak about these other two.
Oh, we have to speak about these other two. Yeah.
Let's kick it off, you know, within a Belgium sort of talking point. Trump obviously wants to go to war. Clinton wants diplomacy. Do you think that something like the Belgium attacks is going to sway, and how, you know, the different candidates respond, does it have the potential to influence voters in a significant way?
I think it's in a very significant way. If you look back before the Paris attacks, this was really an election that was being driven by a lot of other talking points. So look, we were talking about the economy. We were talking about Obama's legacy here in America. We were talking about a lot of these other things. All of a sudden, you had the Paris attacks. You had we had kind of homegrown ISIS-inspired attacks in San Bernardino, California, right here in the United States shortly thereafter. They so significantly change what the election becomes about. All of a sudden, every town hall, every debate, every press conference, every interview the candidates go through are now how to respond to threats of terrorism in the wake of what's going on becomes first and foremost. So a good example is thinking back to September 11th. I was a kid. I was 13 or 14 years old, but I can remember how quickly the temperature of the American people changed, and people were really eager to go to war, sort of as a retribution factor. And we're kind of starting to see that now. I think that's why candidates like Donald Trump, who are calling for such a hawkish military approach in response to this, that's why he's winning. And the cool voices of diplomacy who say, hey, let's play the long-term game. Let's work with our NATO allies. Let's build up coalitions the right way. That voice of reason, as a lot of people may describe it, that's losing out to this kind of frantic, id-driven energy of saying, let's carpet bomb them. I mean, Trump is using all sorts of nasty language to describe the things he would do. He's talking about taking out the terrorists' families. I mean, the man stands there on a debate stage, if you can imagine this, and he's calling for international war crimes, things that are just outlawed by every form or many forms of societies that you can imagine. And he's sitting there as the leading presidential candidate and saying these are things that he would like to see reconsidered. And the American people are being influenced by it right now.
What I just don't get, though, is that is how they are so easily influenced by it. Like how people, you know, given just the history of the world.
Yeah.
And just the history of, you know, that World War One, World War Two, that violence doesn't achieve anything. I don't understand how people can be so inclined to support someone who is so militaristic. I mean, after everything that happened with the Bush administration, that's what I don't understand. I mean, how dissatisfied are Americans with their lives that they feel like, because he's offering sort of, you know, he's got like cheap thrills almost. And you know, there's some stuff that Trump says that's probably really, really good stuff. But it's just a lot of his narrative really is this just instilling fear into people. And I'm just surprised that in 2016, people aren't a little bit smarter to that trick.
Yeah, well, you mentioned a good part when you first started talking, which is the history element. It's like, hey, let's take a step back and look at the history of humankind, right? Like as these elements of history and war and wartime presidencies and you mentioned World War One. I got to be honest with you. These are not things that day-to-day Americans are thinking of. Mm-hmm. And it's not an issue of like, it's not that we didn't learn World War One growing up. It's that we're now in this social media here and now era. We're in this like soundbite, like micro content world of the social media where all that matters is the way we feel and the way we are reacting, the way we're sharing things now. Most American voters, I can assure you, are not going to the polls saying we need to be careful before we vote someone like Donald Trump because 80, 90 years ago, Americans faced a similar threat. They're concerned about now. They're concerned about the live being, the well-beings of their families. Mm. And when a Republican like Donald Trump or someone like Ted Cruz, who's a Texas senator, I know you and I discussed Ted Cruz a little bit last month.
Yeah.
When Ted Cruz sits there and says, we're going to carpet bomb them, which basically means so forcefully laying artillery that it literally covers the ground as if it were a carpet of explosions and wiping out everything imaginable. That is what is winning the day right now. And I don't think people are necessarily geared towards looking at American or world history to influence their voting.
Yeah, I guess it's also just interesting from a South African context. I mean, we have people that, you know, our poverty rates and that kind of thing are so high. And look at a country like America where way more people, you know, percentage-wise have jobs and have fewer reasons to be dissatisfied by life. And then you would think that they would take these other things into account, but it doesn't work like that. Because I guess the ultimate human truth is that no human being is ever going to be satisfied. And if you say things that people want to hear, whether they're rich or they're poor or whatever, just naturally the human ego wants as much as what it can take, and can be influenced if you're saying the right things. I mean, I couldn't believe watching, I was watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, who really went in depth on this Trump wall that he wants to build, the border wall between America and Mexico. And just like the inconsistencies in every speech that he's given around the realities of this wall, like just blatant, like, you know, inconsistencies, whether this thing's going to cost $1 billion, $2 billion, $4 billion. And I just couldn't believe watching that with a guy that's so clearly inconsistent, how there is so much support. But I guess it is. It's exactly what you're saying. It's people are being told what they want to hear. And also, I guess it's that Clinton just doesn't seem that strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And the truth, there's no way to argue with the fact Hillary Clinton is the best suited person for the president, given her experience. You're talking about not only someone who was first lady, and as first lady, as Bill Clinton's wife, she was heavily involved with international diplomacy. She fought for women's rights on a global stage regularly before she ever even considered becoming a senator, which she did. And then she lost election and then became Secretary of State. So you're looking at a candidate there who said, man, she has really done it all as it comes on the global stage. She is right when she says she's the only candidate who would truly be prepared to do the job from day one. But people look at the silly things, Kelman, right? They're looking at it, they're like, well, she yells a little bit when she speaks and we don't like that, or we don't like the things that she wears. And a lot of people are like, that is not what's important when you are choosing the commander in chief to lead your country. So there is like a sexiness factor to Donald Trump, to Ted Cruz, to some of these, as there was Barack Obama. Let's be honest. In 2008, he had that kind of social charisma that people naturally gravitated towards, even though he was a junior senator who had not done a ton in the public sphere. That's still what won out. So I do think Hillary Clinton is in a much better position this time around to win. I do expect that she'll win, but she does have to get over some of those just basic likability factors if she's going to do it.
Well, isn't that what it's all about, though, likability? I mean, isn't that the most important thing?
Absolutely.
So, I mean,
well, let me ask you a question, and I'm curious. I mean, do you see the same sort of decisions being made regarding South Africa or parts of Africa? Is there like a likability factor to the people who rise to the top?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, no one really goes before their vote and looks at the manifesto of a party or reads up in depth on what Hillary may want or a South African leader may want. A lot of it is to do with just your perception of the person. I mean, we have a president in South Africa who is unbelievably charismatic. He's the kind of guy that also has the kind of inconsistencies that a Donald Trump might have in a speech, you know, speaking about something here or there. But it is a likability thing. And this is where I also think it must be, you know, interesting to be inside Hillary Clinton's mind, because I just feel like she's probably very aware of the fact that she isn't just naturally likable, and yet she really is just constantly making this concerted effort to be the next president. And it's like nothing can get this woman down. Like the tenacity that she has is just, she's an example of if people that deal with internet trolls or whatever, they just need to take a feather out of her cap, because literally no comment seems to faze that woman at all. No affair, no comment, nothing seems to faze that woman. She's made of unbelievable tenacity and strength and power and sense of self. And I think she genuinely believes that she would do the best job.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I don't know how heavily this was covered by the global media, but a great example of what you're talking about was back in October. I think it was October 22nd or so. She basically had to testify for 11 hours on national television. It was an entire day. It dominated the airwaves. And in regards to her email server, some actions under her, under this, the second, when she was Secretary of State, regarding military diplomacy and actions that result in the death of Americans, at a Benghazi compound in Libya. And for 11 hours, she sat there and just took this verbal lashing from high-ranking Republicans. And it was all over the national media. It was all over television. And she sat there just cool as a cucumber, as the kids say. And she just rolled with it, and she just hung out, and she said, as long as you're going to hit me with these questions, I'm going to take it in stride. I know that was a defining factor that pushed a lot of influence and a lot of voters to say, you know what, she is cool, she is collected, she does have this tenacity, like you mentioned, that's who we want to be our president.
I want to talk about, for a second, this word talkability. I mean, we look at something like the Never Trump movement, which is, you know, people trying to make sure that this guy doesn't win. But all these movements that are anti-Trump or trying to push that people don't vote for Trump or whatever, doesn't that just give him more talkability and therefore more power and more, you know, awareness in mainstream American media? Is there any thought, I wonder, on the part of the people that are so anti-Trump that maybe their efforts in, you know, trying to get people to not vote for this guy are just really adding to this guy's voice and power and, you know, extent of a microphone when he picks it up in terms of its reach?
Oh, Mike, there's absolutely no doubt that he has capitalized on this sort of Never Trump movement. And before it had this kind of cutesy branding, this hashtag Never Trump, this for many months last summer and last fall, it was really just influential people coming out and saying, you know, this man can never seriously be president, right? So that's really kind of how it started. The man has so cleverly, I mean, the man is a master media manipulator. And so the man has taken all of these sound bites. He's gone out and he basically goes to a very angry percentage of the American people who are disenfranchised with our politics and saying, and he says, look at all these high ranking Republicans. Look at all these high ranking politicians who don't want me in office. I know you don't like them. So that's why you need to elect me as president. And I think our Congress has a record low support number right now among the American people. Politicians tend to be very disliked here in the United States, regardless of who they are. So Trump is capitalizing on that. And you're right. I think another candidate would not be able to know how to manipulate it quite so well as he's been able to do. So there is definitely a double-edged sword. Now, there are voices of support, and they're hoping their voices are going to ring out. Very influential Republican Party candidates. A word you'll hear thrown around here in American media coming is the establishment, which basically just represents these are the Republican figures who have played by the old brand of Republican politics for many generations. They understand and respect the hierarchy of they understand conservative American values, and they are trying their best, and they continue. They have closed door meetings and secret getaways, and it's all aimed at trying to figure out how to dethrone Donald Trump. But everything indicates like there is nothing getting in the man's way, as scary as it is to think is a reality.
The one thing, though, that he can't seem to spin is this violence at the rallies.
Right.
And that is a, that's a real, because I think a lot of people, you know, are seeing that and they're just saying, well, maybe I need to reconsider here a little bit. He hasn't seemed to been able to spin that, you know, when there's been violence breaking out at the rallies. But look at what he's managed to do in the past 15 minutes just in our conversation. He's dominated it. There's been no conversation around Clinton and what she stands for other than, you know, she was on TV for 11 hours. We've basically spoken about this guy. And this kind of is probably why he's going to be the next president, right, JD?
Yeah, absolutely. The man is completely unhinged on Twitter. And if any of your listeners do not follow Donald Trump on Twitter, there's really nothing I would recommend more doing, because – it's an absolute catastrophe. Like, to watch them, he's like a child with no filter who's just given an iPhone and saying, write whatever you want. You can misspell anything. You can retweet any random garbage you find on the internet. And this is the man who may be our next president. And to follow his Twitter feed is an astounding study of the human psyche. It's amazing. The man just has zero regard for the truth. If it's on the internet, if someone can make some completely nonsense graphic and, you know, a photo or something, and he'll just, or like a Photoshop, and he just blasts it out. And the man has like 7 million Twitter followers, yeah, something like that. So that's a good example where people are like, it's kind of like, it's like that train wreck factor. If you know that phrase of like, oh, I can't stop, look, like you can't pull your eyes away from a train wreck. Like, yeah, Trump is a nonstop circus. He is a train wreck. We've never seen anything like it before. And so everyone here is pretty obsessed with it. And by the sounds of it, there are a lot of communities around the world like your own that are also really engrossed with how it's been developing.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, what I really want to just see, though, is 2020 when Kanye goes up against Trump. I think that's I'm going to sit this one out because we can see which direction this is headed in. But I would like to see Kanye versus Donald Trump at some point.
That would really talk about like unhinged Twitter feeds going at it. That would really be something. I agree.
Oh, wow. Well, listen, thank you so much for hanging out. And as always, just so cool getting your insight into everything that's happening over in the States there. Of course, if people want to keep up with you, it is Jive Durkee on Twitter. Very, very cool. JD Durkin, thank you so much for hanging out.
Thanks a lot, man. Happy to do it. Talk to you guys soon.
All right. Listen, this is very important. Would you like to have fun and save money while doing it? Download the Entertainer app from theentertainerafrica.com. Theentertainerafrica.com for 495. That's 495 Rand. And save up to 1.2 million Rand in a year. Whoa. Wow. Jeez. That's amazing. I need to get this app. With the app, you get thousands of buy one, get one free offers from the best restaurants, cafes, attractions, hotels, spas, and more. You can share the app with your family across devices and ping up to 10 offers per year to your friends. Visit theentertainerafrica.com and download the Entertainer app today. The Entertainer app, explore more of the local cities you love so much and save while you do it.
Nick Hellman on CliffCentral.com.